accession number 22353, Rule 4.
Quorum Rule 4.
And this time in the medical was very valuable because we were treating cases that were all sorts. I found myself very interested in a chappie who was having difficulty in breathing, and therefore there had the question of draining his lung, which was quite something, and I took great interest in that. Sister again was very helpful. She obviously they. I think these sisters talk, and like anybody else talks about people, and so I had a very happy time in that area, and the details of which are not particularly interesting, but it was the result was that I came out of the whole period and had gained my acquired second red stripe, which made me now a worthwhile person in the medical world, and so it was that I went back to the unit. And
why had they told you to throw away Pugh's manual?
they had this social life that they wanted very dearly to hang out. Well, sorry, they had got well established, and they were in fact more interested, not more interested because they did their job properly, but they were always they knew who was the proprietor of the cafe in the town where they had had a delivery of bacon and eggs that day, or something of that nature, and a place where to go for dancing. And of course, now yes, the first evening I went down, when you will come to us and you will come and have a meal. So yes, I went down and I had a meal, and of course then they went on to this dancing. I'd never danced in my life, and so I arrived with them, and of course I would talk to anybody, but not necessarily dance with them, because I didn't know much about it. So the next day, of course, they said, that won't happen again. Tonight we're going to teach you to dance. So this was the social life that they were enjoying, and obviously they wanted me to get involved in that rather than stay indoors swatting up Pugh's manual. And so there you are. It was it transpired that I could manage to do one or two things by the time they'd finished with me. But nevertheless, I did also have a good time of studying, and the net result was in gaining this second stripe. Then I returned to my unit, and they said, you've come back with a very good report. We, as you know, have this cottage hospital here, which I've got two wards, I think it was. And so you're on nights now for the next 6 months, on your own. And and that was at Kenfield Hall. And that was a very useful time too, because I enjoyed putting into practice again the stuff that I'd learned, and that it made me more confident in myself as well, being able to run a night of nursing.
Where's Kenfield Hall?
Kenfield Hall was outside Canterbury. It was just the same place, just outside Chartham. And very enjoyable that was, and I was fortunate enough to have a friend who the family who were in Charlton, who said, well, if they're going to put you on tonight, the best thing you can do is to come here and sleep, get some sleep, and then you know, have a sensible life. And that was very good, actually. They provided me with a bicycle, because Len Baldock was the local cobbler, cyclist, a cycle shop, electrician, what do you name it, and in the village he did it. Local taxi, a great fellow was Len Baldock, and so he became exactly what one would need in that sort of situation, and so that was it. I used to finish my stint for the night, immediately ride over to Chartham, and arrive back in time to do my next evening's meal, next evening's stint at the hospital. It was an interesting place, because it was again dealing with mainly. And that was strange, because there was these periods in my army training that sort of concentrated on various things, and these were quinsies, and the quinsy was a particularly nasty development of the throat, and it always had its peculiarities. And one had to do the job of cook and whatever for oneself, and so every night the cook left out the usual piece of steak and some a potato or two and with to make chips, and that's how you existed, and then you had to cook for yourself, and then that and always I just got this meal ready, and I would guarantee that as soon as I got it ready, one of the patients would call out, or call out the best, or make some, or somebody would come and say that this chap was in difficulty, his quinsy had broken. And that was a most filthy sort of job. This sort of quinsy would break, and all these sort of slime and whatnot would come out of his mouth, and I'd have to get him sorted out, get him cleaned up, and back and comfortable again, and then return back to the meal if it was still hot. So one learned to be a patient oneself, besides looking after a patient. But I found it very useful, and I did 6 months of that. And then I think we prepared to move again. And we went to Dover and went into the Royal Infirmary, the Deal Marine Infirmary, and this time there was not much to do, because for anybody it was a matter of sort of waiting. The years are now moving on, obviously, and we found ourselves in need of finding jobs to do, really. And we worked in, we were living in within the precincts of the Deal Infirmary, as it were, in the living in the married quarters. I also, in that time, Jack Dupe, of course, was still an officer and still with us, and he had a car, and of course Jack was also a very pleasant person to be with, and he would say, are you on duty tonight, or are you free, or whatever, you see. And so I would say, well, I'm free. He said, oh, great. I said, well, we'll go to Sal, go to Dover, or go to wherever, and for a meal or something of that nature. And so, and I'll pick you up, you see. So you come and come round into the past the guard on the gate, and do a circuit round into the in the grounds, and stop outside, and I would get in beside him, and off we'd go, and we would go to this whatever he had in mind, and on one of the occasions when I wasn't, that's the next night, I would be obviously not allowed out, type of thing, but in typical manner, he would say, are you in or out? And I said, I'm in tonight. All right, so he came in, drove around the circuit. I would get under the tonneau cover and drive out and stop at the gate, and the guard would say, good night, sir. No, I'll be back, you know. And so he would, just round the corner, out of sight. I would get out, and we would be off for the night. Very, very, very crafty in the army, and you learn to play the game very well. And I think by this time I'd achieved a certain amount of efficiency at that job too. And I decided then that I would, for some reason or other, Lackery Woods was in need of somebody again, so I went in to look after him in the officer's mess. And he was a very, very elderly man, and of course he needed quite a bit of looking after, and he was a bit cantankerous now and again, but generally he was a very pleasant man. And so he said on one occasion, I've got to go to this investiture in London. I said, yes, I've heard. You've got an MBE. So he said, yes, I don't know whether I want to go or not, you see. So I said, well, I think you should. And after a little persuasion, I said, I think you should get yourself out and go. And on the very morning that he should be taking the journey up to London, he said, oh, I'm not going to go. So I said, now, your wife will be looking forward to this. He had spent some time in the salt mines, actually, joined his time in the... So I said, well, you've got the uniform, a new uniform to go in, you've got all this already, I think you should go. And in due time, I persuaded him, and eventually he went, and under great objection, but he went. And so I was pleased that he'd gone, because of this prestige for him, and of course his wife and family would be delighted to have had the opportunity to go with him. So that was okay. And we also had a very nasty sort of chap, again an RSC officer, and it may have been the same chap who was in, I don't know. And he came to me. I was on fire picket, as they called it in those days, or guard duty. And and they were living in a house which was considerable distance from the Deal Infirmary. And so I was designated to go on one of the six to go, and then our shifts were at various times during the night. And this officer came to me and he said, oh, I've sent Squires to do a job for me, and he won't be back for his period on guard. I noticed he's on guard tonight. So I said, they said, you're with him. I said, that's right. Oh, well, he said, when you're ready to do your stint, he said, we did 2 hours on and four off or whatever. And he said, you come to my room and tell me, and I'll come down with you, and I'll do it with you. So I said, all right, very good. And so off he went. And in due time, I was came round for my first, the second. It didn't appear the first stint that I had to do, so I did 2 hours on my own. And the next time round, I went up to his room to tell him and to go in. And I opened the door, and you couldn't see him for smoke, smoke haze. And the smell of spirits was quite strong, etc. I was disgusted in a way, I suppose. But anyway, I told him that I was going at the time. Oh, I'll be down. So, of course, I went down. And again, I was on my own. This was, two to four or something of that nature. And so I stood there, and he made no appearance. And I went back to the guard room, and the space for getting one's head down, as it were, was just very limited. The guard commander said, "Well, you've got a room, but you've got a place here, haven't you? You're in, seeing as you're on the staff down here." So he said, "Oh, go to bed, and it's all right, I've told you to go, and I know where you are if I want to." Sometime after 4 o'clock, it was still quite dark, this chap come, this shaking of me, and, you know, said, "You should be downstairs sleeping, not up here in your bed, etc. You're on a charge, for not being where you're supposed to be," so I. And he hadn't even done his stint or any of the stint. So, anyway, it was the laugh of the officers' mess at breakfast time. And when I went to see Lackery, Lackery Wood was his name, officer's name, he said, "I understand you're on a charge." So I said, "Yes." Well, he said, "You better go and face the music then, get yourself ready." And so, of course, I got myself ready. I went, this lonesome walk to the company office, which was just inside the gates at the infirmary. And I heard behind me the footsteps of our adjutant. I didn't obviously turn round, I knew his footsteps quite easily. And so I arrived at the gate, at the door of the company office, just before he did. And I stood one side to let him in. And he said, "Oh, come in, Warburton." And he said, just got inside, the two of us are on our own. And he said, "Was he drunk?" And I said, "Yes, sir. Thought so. Cheerio. Have a nice day." And so he said, so I went back. And I heard no more about it. But the man was left the unit quite quickly after that. And I think that was the end of his, if it wasn't the end of his career, because I think the colonel sort of chucked him out, as it were. So that was the major things I think I've stay in Deal. They did in fact have problems with the bombs that were being dropped on Deal at that time, and they had things were quite difficult, and some of our chaps went in to sort out the mess, but I didn't get involved. We moved then we were in Deal, some of the chaps were in the companies were in, I think B Company was in Warmer, and other people were elsewhere. So we were spread around quite a bit. And finally, we found ourselves down in, well, I went to a place called Elsnam in Essex, and with a company of, well, with just a few of us under one officer. And we arrived at this place, and I'd only been there about a day or so, and he said, you are, you've got to go home on sick leave, on compassionate leave. And I said, what for? I mean, I don't know anybody that's ill. So he said, I didn't know. He said, but you have to go. I've got to, here's all your information and passes and whatnot. So he said, you have to go. So I went and spent the night in London, down in one of the shelters, and eventually got up to Derby about midday, I suppose. And arrived there, met by a policeman who said, are you Warburton? I said, yes. And he said, Derbyshire Royal Infirmary. So I arrived at Derbyshire Royal Infirmary to find my younger brother, who's now, he's about seven, he was in hospital for meningitis. And my mother and father were there, and they said, oh, good, now you can look after him whilst your father has some rest. And I said, well, I'm only home for 7 days. And such was the dictatorship of one's parents in those days. If that's what my mother said, that's what my mother said. And so I, regardless of the fact that I was now married, so I spent all the nights at my brother's bedside, and I reminded my mother that I would be going, oh no, she said, I shall go and deal with that. And she got an extension. I don't know, she was a very, very sort of difficult lady in a way, and very dominant. And so I had another 7 days doing the same job at home, or at least the Derbyshire Royal Infirmary. And eventually my brother made signs of recovery, and eventually I went back after the second 7 days, and went back to my unit, only to find that we were now moving again, and we were down in Rye. And everything there, of course, was secure. Bolton and whatnot all over the place, and I gathered that we were now waiting for some big event. And the big event, of course, was D-Day, an operation, and everybody was in a state of waiting. And quite remarkable. None of the information got out. Apparently, didn't. We went to. We were in a school, grammar school in Rye, and there we stayed under very tight supervision until we then moved away, and we went on to the football ground at West Ham, West Ham football ground, and spent the night there, and the following day we went down to East India Docks and joined all the rest, it seemed, of the army, because it seemed a boat full of chaps looking out over the side, and the children down on the side, of course, shouting, throw your money down here because you won't need it where you're going. And they also made a lot of money, those kids, as everybody seemed to be emptying their pockets and throwing the money down there. There was no sense of fear as such. I'm sure that everybody was sort of really sort of worried to death about it. And we're on this boat, and it was one of the Liberty ships. I don't know which number, but anyway, we were on this thing with, you know, as a unit, together with Paul and Sundry, and as I gathered over the years, that other people were on the same boat, and they seemed to remember the same things. And we started off down the Thames, and we got past Southend Pier, and the voice of His Majesty the King wished us well and Godspeed, as it were. And that was the... We now found ourselves on our way. And so we came to the... in fact, eventually we arrived in the... off the bay, as it were, where opposite Arimanches.
Was this D-Day itself?
No, it wasn't. We weren't in on the first wave. We were, I don't know, quite a... there was a terrific storm, and this storm seemed to last for 2 or 3 days. And eventually, they dropped the rope ladders down the side, and an American landing craft came along, and the idea was that we now climbed over the rail and down the side of the boat and the ship, and we were in this landing craft, and that was that again was done quite quietly, no sort of panic, no problems whatsoever. Nobody seemed to have any qualms about this journey we were on, and there was that single house. I remember it very, very clearly, just like that single house is there. That was, you'll see it on lots of the photographs. So we were on this now, on this landing craft, and I do remember on board this boat, etc., which the time was interminable. You didn't do anything. You could do anything. You were bobbing up and down. HMS Roberts was about 100 yards away, I should think. It seemed that way. And that has two guns. Only has two guns, as you know, and 2 14-inch guns. And they come up like this, and fire. And that barrel lowers, and the other barrel is now on its way, and that fires. And it's so the only result that has, as far as we were concerned, it bobbed us up and down like a cork. And really, it was quite something. But I spent most of my time on the deck, and a very significant thing is that there was in a cabin of some sort, I suppose, one of the sailors' cabin, he had a record. He was playing a tape, actually, and he was playing, a record, I suppose it was in those days. He was playing a record of the intermezzo from Cavaliere Rusticano, and that piece of music has stayed with me ever since. And I, whenever I've heard on this, I always see myself in this situation, and it's one of the peculiarities of life that some things stick in your mind, I told Anne and his wife about this, and they said how remarkable it was that there should be a piece of music. Didn't matter, it always with me, even as we now were going towards the shore in this thing, this tune was going over in my mind, etc., like a sort of calming feeling. And it was quite real as far as I was concerned, and as the tune played over and over again, because he kept playing it over and over again. And so I then arrived, proceeded in getting nearer to the shore, and all of a sudden this American, we were in charge, captain of the boat, dropped the front down.